we will issue our decision within the statutory time period. Good morning. The next case on our calendar is A18-1307. Pastor David Bacon et al. Versus the Board of Pensions of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, doing business as Portico Benefit Services. Each side will have 15 minutes for their argument, and then the appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If counsel could please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. If you need to adjust the podium, please feel free to do so. You can proceed when you're ready. Thank you. Now, that would have been a little short for you, sir.
May it please the court, my name is Sean Sawyers, representing the plaintiff's appellants. To maintain a class action in Minnesota, a plaintiff must meet the four prerequisites of Minnesota Rule of Civil Procedure 23.01 and one of the three categories of Rule 23.02.
And there's no issue here about 2301, am I correct?
Correct.
That's not before us. So
that's not before
the
court.
And the judge did decide that in favor of your...
In favor of the plaintiffs on the excessive fee claim. That's
all right. So we're really just dealing with the narrow issue of the maintenance, under which category the maintenance of the class action proceeds.
Exactly. The court granted discretionary review to decide whether the class can be maintained under Rule 23.02A when monetary relief is sought.
And is our standard of review abuse of discretion?
The standard of review of a class certification decision is abuse of discretion generally. Here, the district court's determination that plaintiffs were pursuing monetary claim or individual monetary claims is a legal conclusion. So that is reviewed de novo. The underlying facts aren't in dispute. If the district court had made a factual determination on which the decision was based, that would be reviewed for clear error. But here, we're really talking about an issue of law.
Well, what is the difference? I mean, in looking at the different categories. First of all, I want to make sure that I'm reading the rule correctly in 23.02. Are there three or four different ways this could proceed? I mean, in as far as the how this class action is maintained.
Well, there are three different subsections, meaning 23.02A, 23.02B, and 23.02C. The first category, though, 23.02A, has two different provisions. And if either of those are satisfied, then the class action is properly maintained under Rule 23.02A.
All right. And as I understand that, the reason why you might want that is you don't want to give notice to 39,000 participants, right?
That is one reason. There's multiple reasons. One is giving the notice, which would incur a significant cost for the class. If there's a judgment in the case in favor of the class, or if there's a proposed settlement, all the class members would receive notice at that time. But when there's a second round of notice, that can increase the costs substantially. In this case, one of the retirement plans has 27,000 people. The other plan has 12,000 people. The larger plan, it consists of, I believe it's 6,200 different organizations across the country, many that have only a few employees. And that's from the affidavit of Reverend Thiemann, who's Portico's CEO. So the notice would have to be individual notice to people scattered across the country, and the cost of that would be substantial when it's spread out like this.
So that is that really why we're here today?
Is
just the cost involved in giving that notice, and you think that your case qualifies under either 1 or 2A, correct?
That is one reason. The other reason I will say is that if class members have the opportunity to opt out and pursue separate litigation, that could prejudice both sides, both Portico under the first part of Rule 23.02A. They could be subject to incompatible standards of conduct if, say, 5 people opt out and pursue their own cases. Portico could have 5 different judgments requiring 5 different types of conduct on their part.
Well, isn't the only issue here is where the, I mean, I guess it's a multiple issue. Were the fees excessive, and if so, how much?
Right.
Were they excessive?
Were they excessive? Did Portico act with loyalty and prudence?
Right.
And as a result, was the plan harmed, and by how much?
And would there, if individuals opted out and they took their case, I mean, and they came up with a different result, wouldn't that affect the other people in the plan? Or
that would. So if an individual opted out and filed a case and their case, say, was dismissed on the pleadings, that is certainly going to influence the result in our case, at least as a practical matter. That one court has already said that Portico's conduct was lawful, there was nothing wrong with the fees they charge. As a practical matter, that's going to be dispositive of the class's claims in this case.
Well, are there individualized claims here? I mean, how would this work? I mean, if you go to trial and you get an excess fee determination, and would you be asking the court to determine how much that fee was in excess?
Right.
Then how would it be distributed? What would be the mechanism for distributing any payment that would be due by the respondents if you prevail?
We cite in the briefs 501C dot or point 1002, which talks about damages for breach of trust. So the money would be payable to the trust, the amount of the excess, and at that point it would be distributed to the class members pro rata based on their proportional investment in the trust. So there's nothing individualized about that type of determination in the sense that the Walmart v. Dukes case is talking about, where in that case the court talks about an individualized claim, meaning liability depends on the defendant's interaction with each individual employee and whether there was employment discrimination. So determining the merits of each individual's claim in Walmart, the employment discrimination claim, that itself is an individualized determination. In our case, Portico took all of it, all the conduct at issue was taken as to the plan as a whole. It set its administrative fees for the entire plan. Every individual in the plan paid the same percentage of their accounts. So the claims in our case are not individualized.
Much of the briefing focused on monetary remedies, but it's my understanding that you're also seeking injunctive relief. Can you clarify for me the claims you're bringing and the relief you're requesting, or the claims that remain and the relief that you're requesting?
Right. So the prayer for relief, it's a combination of monetary and injunctive or equitable. An example is that going forward, Portico would be enjoined to only charge a reasonable amount. Failing that, that it would be that they would be possibly removed as from their role as trustee and replaced by another trustee. We asked for a competitive bidding process to potentially select a new administrator to replace Portico, who would charge a more competitive rate. So these are some of the types of relief that we're seeking.
But in terms of the monetary relief, I think there's a dispute as to whether or not that's incidental. Can you address that?
Right. So this has come up in a couple contexts in the case. When Portico, the plaintiffs requested a jury trial. When Portico moved to strike that, they argued that the monetary relief was incidental to the injunctive and equitable relief. At that point, we disputed that because the argument was to the effect that, well, this case is really about injunctions and the monetary relief is sort of thrown in as an afterthought just to try to get a jury trial. We disagree with that because the monetary relief is certainly a core aspect of the case. And in the sense that it's discussed in the Walmart opinion, it's incidental. Relief is incidental when it doesn't require an individualized determination. So when there's liability to the class as a whole, and the monetary relief flows directly from that and doesn't require an individualized determination of liability, the disparate merits of each individual's claim, that's when it's considered incidental. So in that sense, the monetary relief is incidental because the monetary reward, it flows directly from a finding that Portico acted imprudently, charged an excessive fee. Once that determination is made, the damages to each person flow directly from that, so it's incidental in that sense.
If the monetary, if the action is predominantly for money damages, do you agree that the class can't be certified under A, that it has to be certified under C based on the Duke's decision?
We disagree with that. As an example, Dukes points out that a limited fund case is a typical Rule 23B1B class action, which is the equivalent of Rule 23.0282. A limited fund case is entirely about monetary relief for individual claimants. So Dukes does not speak to the issue of whether Rule 23B1 precludes any type of claim for monetary relief.
I think that's true, but Dukes does say at 131 Supreme Court 2559 that in the context of a class action predominantly for money damages, we have held that absence of notice and opt-out violates due process.
Right, and that's the Phillips Petroleum versus Schutz case. And that's another case that, again, it's an individualized type of claim. And the court, there was no dispute in that case that the class could only be certified under the third category because it involved claims by plaintiffs in every state in the union who are bringing claims under conflicting state laws. There was no dispute that was an individualized claim. And the court limited its holding to limited the due process holding to a claim for money damages or similar relief at law. That's Phillips at 472 U.S. at 811. And so.
So is a mandatory class consistent with due process where monetary relief is sought?
It is, as long as the type of class action fits into the traditional categories that are set forth in Rule 23.02A and the federal equivalent 23B1. The Ortiz case, it talks about due process concerns arising when the plaintiffs try to fit a claim that doesn't, that isn't among the traditional categories of Rule 23B1 or 23B2 classes. When they tried to fit that type of claim, the individualized claim, without the opt-out and due process rights, that's when due process concerns arise. But if the court acknowledged that if it was a true limited fund case, which is a quintessential example of a of what 23B1 is designed to cover, there would not have been due process concerns, even though monetary relief is at issue.
Could you, I mean, I'm looking at the Dukes case, and could you explain to me why, I mean, there was a finding that, or at least the holding was there was no commonality.
Right.
So they didn't even get past, you know, the threshold. Why was it necessary to go ahead with the next step? I mean, was that...
Talk about the category?
And talk about the maintenance category.
Yeah, really it wasn't, since the Supreme Court's the court of last resort, that once the commonality isn't there, the maintenance category is irrelevant at that point.
Well, and there's three categories, and the category in Dukes was the injunction category, correct?
Right.
But neither, it appears that you aren't pursuing that.
We're not pursuing that.
And what are the pros and cons of not pursuing, you know, just the injunction category as opposed to these other categories?
Well, I think it's something we could have considered, but since monetary relief is a significant part of the case, and the language of the injunction category doesn't specifically provide for it. But courts in breach of trust cases have consistently found those claims are proper under the B1 or O2A category, that we found that would be preferable. And I see that I'm out of time. We'd ask that the court reverse. Thank you.
Thank you.
This happens all the time.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Chris Wales on behalf of the Defendant Board of Pensions of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, which I'll refer to as Portico, and with me at counsel table is Debbie Davidson of my firm. So the question here really is, does due process require that the 40,000 or so members of the plaintiff class receive notice and an opportunity to opt out of a case that's seeking to recover money for their individual retirement accounts? Plaintiffs, although they represent the class, seem to want to keep the class members in the dark about the lawsuit.
Well, you characterize, well, plaintiffs, they're appellants here, but you characterize a due process issue, but is it really a due process issue, or stepping back, whether or not it fits under 2302A or 2302C in terms of certification with respect to the whether the claims are individualized or not. That seems to be more the heart of the issue here. And here you've got the claim is for breach of fiduciary duties and breach of trust of the management of two retirement plans. That seems to be a fairly broad issue, an overarching issue rather than a specific issue, where in Dukes you had all these different parties, you had different managers, you had different employees, you had different fact scenarios that seem to indicate that's individualized. This seems to be not individualized because it's a broader claim against Portico.
I can address that, Your Honor. First of all, the question in Dukes about the individualized nature of the claims really went to the issue of commonality and typicality, which is the first threshold. So that's really not under consideration here. The question
And actually, to that point, it seems like the facts in Duke are very, very strikingly different than the facts that we have here. So how does Dukes even apply in the first place?
Well, Dukes applies because it articulates what the outer limits are, really, of the mandatory class. So the rules in Minnesota set up a structure where there are two subdivisions under which people are bound by the result in the case without having been told about it and without having an opportunity
well,
to opt
did,
out.
Well, did Dukes address the federal equivalent of 2302A?
It was a 23B2 case, which is the equivalent of 23.02B here. So you are correct that it was dealing with a subdivision that the appellants did not move. They did not move for certification under that.
Right. So that's another way where Dukes
well,
is different than
yes,
the facts
it,
that we have
Dukes,
here.
We don't disagree that Dukes is different in some respects, but the concepts and the principles that Dukes adopts inform what is permissible in terms of a mandatory class. It was doing so in the context of B2 under the federal rules, but it applies equally to a mandatory class under what is here 23.
Well, it could persuasively, but it's not binding on our interpretation of the application of 2302A because it never addressed 2302A.
Your Honor, I disagree with that. I think that's an overly narrow interpretation.
Well, but that's how we interpret case law. We look at the cases in light of the facts that are presented and the issues that are argued, including the legal issues, which nobody disputes that 2302, the interpretation of 2302A is a legal question, right?
Right. But what Dukes says is that individualized monetary claims cannot be in a mandatory class, okay? It was dealing with B2.
Though,
pardon?
Given, how are these claims really individualized? Because the issue is the fees charged by the plan, and they didn't, there wasn't a different fee structure for each individual. It was a consistent fee structure by plan, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. The individualized nature of it goes to the relief that's being sought, which is, I mean, this is a defined contribution plan. It consists of individual accounts of thousands of people within this plan. And if, in fact, there is a judgment in favor of the plaintiff's appellants, they will receive money that will go to their individual retirement accounts.
But how does that really matter, though? Because that's going to flow from whether or not there was a breach or not, that determination, that overarching determination. Once that's made, then, yeah, different people are going to get different results. But that one issue is going to determine whether or not either party prevails. Whereas in Dukes, you had all these separate issues. You had these separate claims and separate sets of facts, separate different witnesses. That does seem to harbor why there would be individualized, why it would be individualized. Whereas here, you've got this global claim. It's either you win or you don't. Here, the facts centered on each individual, and each one was different.
Okay, but that, again, is an issue of liability, right? So the individualized nature of the liability was a question that the Supreme Court considered in deciding whether or not the case should be certified, and there were common issues of fact. When it got to the question of what the relief being sought, they were dealing there with back pay. And the court said back pay in this particular context is a monetary remedy, right? It sounds in equity, but it is still a monetary remedy. And it is individualized in the sense that each individual will be entitled to a different amount depending upon the outcome of the case. I do agree that there are some distinctions to be drawn with Dukes, but the overall concept, which is if the monetary relief is being sought, and there's no question here that it is principally what's being sought, right? I mean, okay. The appellant's counsel said that monetary relief is a core aspect of the case, a significant aspect of the case.
Want to stop you there because you said something about whenever monetary relief is being sought. And the way I read your brief, it sounded almost like a strict rule of if any time a party is seeking monetary relief, then that rules, and that harbors to application of 2302C, and 2302A is never available for class certification. Am I reading that wrong? Or let me ask you a different question. In what scenario would a party that's seeking monetary relief still be entitled to class certification under 2302A?
The classic example would be I could think of two examples. One would be a limited fund, right? That would be under the Minnesota A2 provision, correct? Where there is a set amount of money, a limited asset, which multiple people have claims to, right? So we're not arguing for a per se rule by any means.
How is that different than here?
Well, here we don't have, the only common is that there's a corpus of money, but this is not a case where there are multiple claimants trying to have the trust divided up among themselves, correct?
But okay, so here you have parties trying to get, one of the things that they're trying to do is get money that they claim has been, or that they've been overcharged for.
Right. They're trying to get it from the fiduciaries of the plan, not from the trust itself. So it's not a case where there are competing, inconsistent claims on a single corpus where a determination as to one of them would automatically affect the rights of the other. So that is really the principle that they're talking about under
A2.
But here
they're also they're also seeking injunctive relief, and it seems to me there's a potential for inconsistent decisions if there's multiple actions relating to the same claim, inconsistent remedies by different courts.
Your Honor, so they do talk about, there's no question that a portion of this case is seeking injunctive relief.
Isn't that a real possibility here?
Well, no.
If some of the beneficiaries can opt out and bring their own lawsuit, couldn't you have inconsistent remedies ordered by two different courts?
Well, okay. Are you speaking exclusively of the injunctive relief? Because I think as to monetary relief, the answer is no, because the payment of money to different people is not going to put inconsistent obligations on Portico, right? So they win one case, they lose another, they win another, they have to pay individuals. I think you're talking about the possibility that one court would order the removal of Portico as the trustee and another court would not. I think that's the example they use, or asking that there be some sort of bidding. You know, those are really rather far-fetched given the nature of this particular.
Well, why are they far-fetched?
Go ahead.
Well,
and why? I mean, you know, if people are allowed to opt out, what would stop someone from saying, I know that they have an expert that says the excess fee is this amount, but I think that's way too low. I want to go a lot higher. And then you've got inconsistent verdicts as to what the excess was on the fees.
Well, that
right,
Your Honor, that seems to be something that the courts contemplate could happen, and that the mere existence of inconsistent rulings on damages is not the type of sort of inconsistent obligation.
Well, but it even goes further than that, because that one court may decide there's no excess. I mean, that there's no liability.
Right. Well, these are really.
So these are, I mean, isn't this case? Because I understand in Dukes, there's so many different fact situations that I can understand why the Supreme Court reached the decision it did. But in Dukes, no matter, even if there was a systematic finding of discrimination, I would assume the defendant there would be wanting to contest individual claims because of the different fact situation. But here, we don't have any of that. It's either there was a breach of fiduciary duty because of an excess fee, or there wasn't. And if there was, then how much was it? And that would apply to everyone.
Your Honor.
And so what involvement would there need to be for the respondent to stay in this, you know, once there's a determination to stay in the case?
Well, Your Honor, the issues that you've identified, I mean, that's the portion of the rule that's designed to protect the defendant, Portico, here. So the fact that people may opt out and may choose to pursue their own claim separately is a risk that the defendant is willing to bear by virtue of arguing that it should be an opt-out class, right? So it's a funny situation where the plaintiffs want basically to have everybody wrapped in. There are the possibility that opt-outs will take action and may file their own suit. We don't think that's likely here. I mean, there's 40,000 people in this plan. Four of them happen to have become plaintiffs here. Most of the participants are ministers of the church.
Whether it's likely or not, it's possible. So
it is a possibility.
Address the real questions.
Right. Well, the question is, would, you know, is the fact that Portico may be subject to other suits for money a reason for for granting a mandatory class and requiring? And, you know, I think that we've made a persuasive argument that the relief, injunctive relief here, is not really of a nature that would impose incompatible standards of conduct, in part because Portico is required by the church, by the Lutheran Church, to be the administrator of this plan and to be the trustee. So we start to get into religious entanglement arguments when the relief they're seeking is to have Portico removed, which would directly violate the church.
That's a separate issue. But, I mean, even the appellants here raised a number of requests for relief that could very easily be raised in other litigation, other courts, in terms of either removal or bidding process or ordering Portico to charge a reasonable amount, and what would that reasonable amount be? So I think there's already a basis where other parties could come in if they opted out, other members, if they decided to opt out, could seek different types of relief. It seems to be not only for the benefit of Portico, but all the parties, as well as just in the interest of judicial economy, to have one court address all these issues through class certification, through 23A, where you've got 2302A, where you've got everybody all together and binding everybody in one judgment. Why is that?
Well, Your Honor, I guess the question is, do those issues of convenience and efficiency really override the due process rights of the individuals who will be bound by the result in this case without having received notice and not having an opportunity to say that they don't want to participate? And I do see my time's up.
Counsel, I have one additional question for you. In the Kruger case, the court relied in part on the advisory committee notes to Rule 21B1B to find that certification under the equivalent, to 23.02A was appropriate for that in that case. And so can you comment on the applicability of that advisory note and why that wouldn't support certification under A2 in this case?
I believe you're talking about the advisory note that deals with sort of the species of limited fund, and they speak about a breach of indenture trust. Is that...
Well, breach of trust by a fiduciary. Why wouldn't that apply here as well?
I
can quote it for you if you'd like.
Okay, that would be great. Thank you.
This is on 577 going to 578. It's on page 19 of the Westlaw version I printed out, but it states, plaintiffs also point to the advisory committee notes to Rule 23, which provide that class certification is appropriate under Rule 23B1B in, quote, an action which charges a breach of trust by an indenture trustee or other fiduciary, similarly affecting the members of a large class of security holders or other beneficiaries, and which requires an accounting or like measures to restore the subject of the trust.
Right,
and
yeah.
then later on, the court says the court finds that the class certification in this case is proper under Rule 23B1B. First, as an example, as in the example provided in the advisory notes, plaintiffs here, quote, charge a breach of trust by a fiduciary affecting a large class of beneficiaries, which requires accounting to restore the subject of the trust, period, unquote.
Okay. Yes, I think what those advisory committee notes were talking about was really what I mentioned before, the limited fund, right? So they're talking about an indenture trustee where they're holding a security, where there are multiple security holders who have competing claims to that, okay? That's not the case here. What we have
But that's not in the language of the advisory committee notes. And that the Kruger case, that's a District of Minnesota case, which is something that while it's persuasive authority, it's fairly persuasive because it's coming out of our federal courts here.
Well, I believe that the note that as read does specifically say a breach of trust by an indenture trustee.
It says a breach of trust, yes, by an indenture trustee or other fiduciary similarly affecting the members of a large class.
Right, where there would be an accounting, where there would be a trust, a breach of trust, and there were competing claims to the corpus of the trust, and there would need to be a mandatory class in order to decide what those people's competing rights would be. We don't believe that's the situation here,
so,
where you have...
And do you think that language also did not apply to the 401k retirement plan at issue in the Kruger case?
Yes, we do not believe that that was properly decided given the due process considerations and the limits of a mandatory
okay,
class.
So you challenge the Kruger decision. You dispute that then?
We don't believe it was correctly decided in light of Dukes and LaRue and other cases.
Go ahead.
I just want to understand what's going on here because you want to proceed under C.
Correct.
Correct. What's the advantage to your client in proceeding under C as opposed to A1 or 2?
Well, one advantage is that many pastors of the Evangelical Lutheran Church may not wish to be members of this suit.
But
and they would have the opportunity to opt out. Because they have individual retirement accounts, which would be affected by this, and they would have the opportunity to decide that they don't want to be a part of this suit after learning about it. Okay, and we don't think that notice is really a big issue here. I mean, we're talking about printing some pages and mailing it to people, right? And you know that's a cost that ultimately can be recovered in this case. So I don't think that this big impediment that cost is really driving this here. I mean, to me, it's really about fairness and about whether these 40,000 people out there should have the right to know about this and should have the ability to opt out if they so choose. If they want to pursue their own case, they can. And that is a risk that Portico is prepared to take on.
And that cost, if the plaintiffs prevail in this action, is that a cost that your client may ultimately be responsible for?
The cost of notice? I believe notice costs can be recovered, but I'm not absolutely sure. I believe they can be, yes. So it might ultimately come back on us, yes. So that would be a negative, but we think that the weighing the considerations that the due process issues outweigh what is really the cost associated with giving notice.
All right, thank you very
thank
much.
You.
We have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just to touch on the Kruger decision briefly, Portico referred to it as a species of limited fund case, but I think in the Ortiz decision makes clear that a breach of trust case is a distinct type of action from a limited fund as far as the classic rule 23B1B categories. And the language restore the subject of the trust does not sound like claimants making a a claim against a single REIT. It sounds like augmenting the amount of the trust estate. And Krueger is consistent with a number of ERISA cases, probably dozens that we cited in the briefs, that routinely certify fiduciary breach claims under Rule 23B1, the federal equivalent of 23.02A, particularly when affirmative relief is joined with monetary relief.
Well, what about the last argument made by counsel that why not go under C? Then you don't have any due process concerns, and any of these outliers who want to opt out of this can do so. And ultimately, if you prevail or your client prevails, they might have to bear the cost of any notice.
In our experience, the notice costs come out of the gross recovery, so that would reduce the amount that's ultimately distributed to the class. And this case is about paying unnecessary costs. So a round of notice that's not going to serve any useful purpose and could potentially lead to prejudice if there are other claims filed. We object to that. Portico, they speculate that we want to keep the class members in the dark, that our motives are irrelevant. The rule itself does not require notice when the claim fits under Rule 23.02A, as it does here. The drafters of the rule, they considered the due process implications of not providing notice and opportunity to opt out, and determined it was appropriate if the claim does meet the requirements of the rule, as it does here.
So it's your position that this going under C could end up with inconsistent results that may prejudice your client?
Yes, that's right. So if there aren't any other questions, the plaintiffs would ask that the...
Well, I going back to Judge Hooten's question, the Supreme Court did seem to be really focused on due process, and so why shouldn't the other plan members be given an opportunity to opt out? Is there really a risk of harm to your clients?
Sure.
Or to inconsistent verdicts?
Right. If someone opts out and pursues a claim and loses, that could be dispositive of the entire class's claim. And the reason there's no due process concern is because the claim is so cohesive that the representatives in this case adequately represent the interests of the absent class members. When there's an individualized employment discrimination claim where that depends on the particular witnesses, the strength of the proof, someone might have a particularly strong claim. It's not necessarily the case that their due process rights are protected in that circumstance, but that doesn't exist here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very interesting case. We will look very closely at this matter, and I appreciate the good briefing and good arguments here today. So thank you. We will issue our decision within the 90-day statutory time period. We are going to take a short break, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.